This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you can.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. Excited for this episode. There's a lot going on in markets, and we love the fact that we get to pick the brains of experts and trying to figure out what's going on.
That's it. Well, speaking of experts, a reminder before we start, we're not experts. We're not financial professionals. We are not licensed. We're here learning just like you, and nothing on this podcast should be taken as advice. Do not take financial advice from a podcast. But it is our pleasure to welcome Nathan Bell to Equity Mates. Nathan, how are you?
I'm well, boys.
So Nathan is head of research and portfolio management at InvestSmart. He discovered value investing after spending 9 years as an accountant, including 5 at Deutsche Bank, that ended in 2006, and has been with Intelligent Investor ever since. He is a CFA charter holder, and his experience has guided their strong performance at InvestSmart since 2011. So hoping to pick your brains on that.
Hoping Nathan. To get some of that guidance today, Nathan.
Yes.
The irony is I think I've done a lot better for our investors than I've done for myself.
Well, Nathan, before we get into all of that, we love to start these interviews by hearing about your first investment. We generally find there's a good lesson or story that comes out of it. So can you take us back and tell us the story of your first investment?
Yeah, I've got a classic Tabcorp when it first listed as an IPO when the government sold it off. I reckon it was maybe about 1994, and I reckon I was at maybe the end of year 12 or start of university, and I had a little bit of money from working at Kmart during the school holidays. And I remember I come from Mount Gambier in country South Australia, and I always knew for some reason I wanted to be an investor. I think it came down to the fact that my parents were divorced when I was young. We never had any money, and I just wanted something else. I was tired of always struggling, and this stock market just seemed to be this place where all you had to do was have the right opinion and you had to have patience. And there was something about the grit and the patience that I just understood just in my DNA. And it wasn't about being the smartest person. It was about being sensible and having common sense, but really that idea of grinding it out. And that's sort of something that for some reason appealed to me, but it didn't appeal to me when it came to my Aussie Rules footy career. So in the Border Watch was the local paper. And I remember Tabcorp had the IPO, and this guy said, I think it listed at $1.35. And he said, look, I think this stock's going to be worth $4 over time. And I thought I was a long-term investor. And after 6 months, I got frustrated because the share price hadn't gone anywhere. And I gave up and I sold my stock, and I made a classic profit of 1 cent after brokerage fees.
Love that.
Now, I think that stock went on, actually not exactly sure because it's been in so many reincarnations since that original float, but I think that it was at least a 4 or 5 fold increase eventually, if not maybe even 10. So it was an enormous lost opportunity, and I really got lost in the wilderness for a long time after that, trying all sorts of different things like technical analysis and just a whole heap of wasted time. So it was a good experience in one sense. And I think one of the worst experiences some people can have is actually make a lot of money on a punt, particularly when they're young and they think it's easy. And then when they've actually got some meaningful money behind them, they end up losing it because they think they can just pick anything. And so there's good lessons there, but I wish I had probably learned some better lessons about long-term investing.
So from that experience, Nathan, how would you describe your investment philosophy today?
So I've been a professional investor since 2006, and I call myself a value investor. And there's always this, I don't know whether it hits the guys at your age, whether you get this deep into it, but there's this idea that a value investor somehow has got to buy these cheap, ugly, cheap statistical businesses on high dividend yields and low price to earnings ratios. And somehow by buying cheap, you make all this money as, that people or the market recognizes that actually it's a better business than what it's being priced at. Now, Warren Buffett, who's considered the greatest value investor in history, has actually been telling everyone who will listen for about 40 years that the best way to make money is to buy the best businesses and the ones that can reinvest their profits at the highest rate of return for the longest. And to me, that's what value investing really is the compromise between those two things, because essentially you've got to pick between a few key attributes of all businesses, and whether it's management, the growth of the company, the quality of the company, and then what the valuation is telling you. You're never in a market where things are perfect. Occasionally you get into a GFC but even then you've got to make a choice. Do I buy the absolute best businesses on the market? They're going to compound my wealth at 15% a year for the next 20 years. Or do I buy those really deeply discounted stocks that are being particularly impacted by whatever the current events of the day are, where you might be able to make 10 times your money in like a couple of years, but you know that once you've made that 10 bagger, you then have to sell it and pay tax and then find the next stock. And by that time, all the great stocks have recovered to full prices again. So that's really what the balance of, I think, value investing is all about. But to anyone young listening, to me, the best advice I could give anyone is just find the best business you can find and put all your money in it and just let it grow and do nothing and don't listen to anyone else.
Yeah, it's easy.
A lot of mistakes that get made.
That's easy to be
said. It really is.
The challenge is just finding the best business.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll ask you that later. But Nathan, before we get there, I reckon if you surveyed all investing content across social media, podcasts, written stuff, even in the AFR, all of that, 90% plus would be about what to buy, and there's very little discussed about actually how you build and then manage a portfolio of stocks. And so part of your role at InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor is head of portfolio management. And so we're really interested to talk about that for a moment and talk about not just finding that stock, but then how you actually manage a portfolio of stocks. So to start broadly, do you have any key principles of portfolio management that you apply across InvestSmart's portfolios?
Yeah, look, this is a fantastic topic, and I'm glad you've brought it up, because it's sort of almost, I think, what most people consider one of the more boring topics of investing, and you really don't hear anything about it. Yet it is, to me, the most critical part of putting a portfolio together, because the amount of money you invest in a stock compared to the overall size of the portfolio, to me, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's where ego is involved, the confidence in your analysis, the trying to be balanced about the risks. Yet if you don't put enough into the great business and it goes up tenfold over a decade, you don't really make much money. Yet you put too much into a bad stock that doesn't work out and you lose too much money. And there's no rules for this. And that's what makes it, it's an art. It's not science. It's an art. But there are definitely a few rules that govern the way I manage the portfolios at Intelligent Investor. And this is a case of do what I say and not what I do, because personally I run a very concentrated portfolio and I don't recommend that for most people. I just don't think people can stomach the swings and being wrong. And I think you do need to be an expert and be on top of your stocks all the time if you're going to do that. But the one principle for me is always never put a lot of money in a lousy, low-quality business where you can't stomach the losses. And the thing you have to remember with a professional portfolio is you're not investing for you personally. So what risk is and the amount of volatility in the portfolio for me might be very, very comfortable, and it is. But to, your nan and pop or your parents who can't afford to lose any money, who aren't working anymore and are relying on that dividend income or those capital gains over time, that's a very serious obligation. And there's a certain expectation that If you're very lucky and you run maybe a small portfolio of just friends and family, that you might be able to impress on them the understanding of volatility doesn't mean risk. And it's a very hard concept, I think, for people to understand, because it's all well and good in a bull market, but as soon as you get into a bear market and the portfolio is going down and the people don't really understand the businesses that they own, they panic and sell out. So there's a certain amount of volatility I think our investors can handle, but there's a certain amount that they can't. So normally I sort of have in my head the 2-4-6 principle. It doesn't work exactly like that, but the 6% is reserved for what I think are the cheap, highest quality businesses when I first buy them. You know, the 4% I'd say is an average holding, because we tend to run with about 25 stocks in the portfolio. But I find once you get into the 20s, the quality of the ideas are pretty poor. But I also find if you only have 15 stocks, then you've got about 7% invested in each one, and some of those are going to be small caps. So if they have a really bad result or they just don't work out, now, that's a big loss for people to take fairly quickly. So I find the 25 tends to be where the balance lies. And remember, you've probably your top 10 stocks are the ones that drive the performance of your portfolio. So as long as they're right, the rest takes care of itself. And you've probably got a bunch of stocks that you're slowly selling out of, plus another bunch of stocks where you're not quite sure yet, or maybe they're risky for some reason but could have big returns. So they're the smaller positions. So you tend to have sort of quite a long tail where the top 10 stocks are probably 50 to 60% of your portfolio, and then you've got the 30 or 40 in the smaller stuff. So if you're wrong or something goes wrong, you know, it's a manageable risk and you move on.
Love that.
So the 2% is really safe for the more speculative stuff. I mean, we are looking for the high quality stuff, but you just find smaller stocks sometimes that carry risks, and maybe we'll talk about them later. And you want something, and there's no point putting 0.5% or 1% in them usually, because even if they work out, they're probably not going to do anything. Although, you know, we've been invested in Whitehaven Coal at a dollar, you know, 15 months ago, and now it's $8. So you only need 1% in that. But that's not usually how it works. I'd say the average is 4%. And again, if it's a new stock, you probably want to build up your knowledge of it a bit over time. So you might want to start smaller to begin with. And then as you get more confident, you might invest more. There's certainly no way to really feel like you own a stock until you actually own some of it. So one thing I do occasionally is just buy a very small bit of it, and then just follow it and get to know it, because you don't really understand a business, in my view, until you listen to the CEO speak 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and then you really, really know what's going on, and you can really check whether this is BS and whether this is a guy who's really in it for the right reasons. And it just takes a bit of time sometimes to get that right.
So I guess the follow-on from that, so as a retail investor, we're sitting here and we happen to get a stock that 10 bags or whatnot, and it becomes a large portion of our portfolio. We're loving it. It looks great. Do you, if that were to happen to you, you know, you've got the 6% rule there for the greats, do you make sure that you don't allow a stock to balloon too much, or how do you let a stock run without kind of cutting that opportunity short?
Yeah, Peter Lynch, I'm sure you've heard this, always says, you know, don't cut the flowers and water the weeds. So you really need to be careful. And there's an old, I think it's a money management adage, or maybe it's a trader adage, that you want to let your profits run. So, and I'd also add on to that, that when you get those stocks right, I hear this about CSL all the time, right? So, you know, there's a lot of people who CSL makes up 70 or 80% of their portfolio because it's just done so well since they got shares in the IPO in 1992 or whenever it was. And they say, you know, I'm not sure what to do with it. I know this is an outrageous amount of my portfolio, but if I sell it, I've got this enormous capital gains that's probably the equivalent of like paying 60% of the share price once I pay the tax. And if the share price fell by 40%, I'd be buying more of the stock. So I actually think if you can handle it, because every stock can fall by 50% or more at any time for some reason, and particularly CSL, in the sense that I think everyone thinks it's the safest business on the market, and then arguably certainly one of them, but technology changes, world moves on, sometimes they miss a particular product launch or a particular part of you know, the healthcare economy and solutions, and if they miss that, and I know competitors are working on a lot of blood products trying to catch up to CSL, so if they work and prices come down for their products, you know, whatever it is, if you can't stomach that 50%, then, and you can't sleep at night, then you've got too much. But in terms of the portfolios at Intelligent Investor, we're only allowed to hold a maximum of 15% in any one stock at any time. And so let's say I put in that full whack of 6% at the start and it, you know, it's up 150%, then I'm forced to start trimming that. But once we're getting to 9 or 10%, like that's you're taking on a lot of reputation risk, I think, as a fund manager. And a lot of people, I think, aren't willing to admit that they'll make decisions based on reputation and business risk and career risk rather than just focusing fully on the investment. Because if you, you know, we saw this years ago in the US, there's a bunch of hedge funds, like Valiant Pharmaceuticals was one of the business fund managers with the highest reputation ever in history, had 30% of their portfolio in Valiant and it blew up. You know, this is a business that had been around for, I think, 40 or 50 years, and Warren Buffett had recommended it to his clients when he decided to stop managing his own clients' money. So it takes 40 or 50 years to build the reputation of this business, and it took 5 minutes to lose it. So you're always trying to strike that balance between hanging on to your winners, because if you know you've got the great business, you know it inside out, you understand the risks. Once you sell it, you bring all these new risks into it. You've got to find a new stock. It won't be as good. It'll be more risky, you know, and then you've got to pay the tax. So there's all these costs of selling this great business. And I think it's a great question. And again, it just shows you the art of investing. And it's so personal. You know, carrying 15% in one stock for you might be absolutely fine. For someone else, they might think you're crazy, and you know, 4% is a big position for them. So, as a mentor of mine always says, you know, investing is such an individual journey, but you've got to bring that individual journey to a bunch of, you know, mums and dads, and that's very different from managing your own portfolio.
Well, speaking of the portfolios you manage at InvestSmart, there I believe you manage three. You might manage more. There's an ethical fund, an equity growth fund, and an equity income fund. How do you think about managing the different portfolios, and are there different rules that you have to apply to each of them, or do the principles sort of carry across them all?
So I start in my fantasy world where every stock is cheap and it's growing at 20% a year. And it has a dividend yield of 5% fully franked. And therefore, all three portfolios have the same 20 or 25 stocks in them, and I don't have to do anything.
Would be
so
nice.
So starting from that base, the one with the most freedom by far is the growth fund. And the ones with the you know, the big hurdles on them are the income fund, because obviously you've got to have a competitive yield. You know, I'd say as it's more of a dividend growth fund necessarily than I think a classic income fund that a lot of people probably think, where they're just trying to maximize the dividend yield and the franking credits. You know, we still have to outperform the market by 1%. That's what we've told people. So we really need growth in that income portfolio. So the classic stock for me, the one that went right across all three portfolios. So just lastly, the ethical fund obviously has the ESG filter on it. So no fossil fuel companies, no gambling, just all the main things that people will understand. And there's nothing unique in our filter. But the perfect stock for us was a company called Pinnacle Funds Management. And I'd followed this company for a long time. I'd bought a little bit of it and it fitted perfectly for all three portfolios. It was a rapidly growing business. You know, it's grown earnings and dividends at 50% a year for the last 4 years.
Wow.
You know, had insider owner management, which I love, is something that's really important to me, which we might get to later. And it paid, because when these funds management businesses are going great, their profit margins are absolutely enormous, because you don't have to pay anything for the next dollar of revenue. It all just goes straight to the bottom line, so they can pay out all their profits as dividends. You know, and they were fully franked. So when we got the bear market 3 years ago and the stock fell to $2.50, I bought more of that stock and, you know, made it a 4 or 5% position across all three portfolios. Today, that stock's trading about $11, but it was on, went to 20, come back to 6, and now it's back to 11. But the fully franked dividend yield at the moment, without the franking credits on that $2.50 purchase price, is 14.5%.
Wow.
Now, like that to me is dividend investing. Mm. I just want a portfolio full of 25 pinnacles in all three. But I know with the income fund, I have to at least be competitive with the yield of the ASX, which at the moment is about 5%, but it's being juiced up by the iron ore miners. So, you know, on an underlying basis, assuming the iron ore price comes down and dividends get cut a bit more, you know, maybe it's, let's say it's 4.3%. So I can't go out there and say this is an income fund with a yield of 2%, because otherwise it's just like the growth fund. In saying that, I will just say that the distribution did get cut quite drastically for 12 months during the COVID bear market, because a whole bunch of companies we owned and bought which were the best, you know, the airports, the casinos, you know, but they all cut their dividends during that period. So they're all bouncing back now, which is fine. But I really want to keep the portfolios as simple as possible. And that's the biggest lesson I'd say to anyone listening is keep your investing simple, because every time in my life where I've tried to make it, you know, chase returns or diversify overseas or whatever, like there's been definitely some gains at times, but the thing that works best is keep it simple. So I just try as much as I can to have a core bunch of great companies across all three portfolios, and that makes it a lot easier.
So Nathan, before we turn our attention to earnings season, we're just going to take a quick break to hear from some of our sponsors.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Nathan, earnings season, we're in the thick of it here in Australia. It's been going on for about a month now over in the States. What have you learnt so far about what the companies have been reporting or some of the guidance that they've been delivering, and anything that you'll be keeping an eye on going into the next reporting season?
Look, the thing is there's been a lot of lack of guidance, which you probably expect from people, because the earnings are looking backwards, right, over the past 12 months. And the last 12 months is not going to be indicative of what it's going to be like most likely for the next 12 to 18 months, where interest rates are finally going to start having an impact on the economy. Because keep in mind that most of the world's on fixed interest rates on their mortgage rates. You know, so America doesn't have variable interest rates. So they're putting up their interest rates. Australia at the moment, I think about 45% of all loans are still on fixed mortgage rates. So it's going to be at least another year before we see higher interest rates across the board really start to impact the economy. So you've got a lot of companies that were huge beneficiaries of COVID who are now starting to show much slower revenue growth as was expected. And there's still some companies that are hurting from the post-COVID hangover, and that's going to be a slow return. And airports are a good example. I mentioned the casinos. So it's really been all over the shop, because you can't even say, look, all the technology companies have been going great, because if you look at Xero, and the share price has come way down, like it got crazy to start with, but people are worried about slowing UK subscribers, which is a huge, you know, part of the value that people have priced in. Then you look at WiseTech yesterday, just, you know, produced this absolute bonanza of a result, and you're sitting here wondering why you didn't buy it earlier. And so you can't even say it's like by sector almost, right? It just depends on the business. It's so unique to the business because of the unique cross current of events we've got right across the board, from the war in Ukraine and staff shortages and all the rest of it. But the one thing you can certainly say is the costs are going up. Profit margins are getting squeezed and valuations are still enormously high. And just to give one example which caught my attention is Fisher & Paykel Healthcare, which is another one of the many stories I could tell you about bailing out way too early for stupidly thinking it was expensive at $3.50. And, went to $35. It was probably another $5 of dividends. You know, went to $40 and we bought it at $2.20 and sold at $3.50 many years ago because the price to earnings ratio of like 22 looked a bit expensive. And just don't fall for these PE ratios and all this sort of stuff. Just find the great businesses that are growing and hang on to them. And it's all in the hanging on to them is where the money's made over a long period of time. But the earnings have really come back. I think earnings per share might be lucky to be 35 cents this year, where they were like 92 or something the year before, because Fisher & Paykel Healthcare, you may know, they have a sleep apnea business. Mm. They also have an oxygen therapy business. So they install these, humidifiers and whatnot in hospitals and for people who need oxygen care. And the sort of range of therapies they're using it for is improving. You know, for COVID, they just bought, you know, all the hospitals said, look, we just need it all and we need it now. Mm. So I think Fisher & Paykel got something like 5 or 6 years or more of hardware sales into the hospitals in 12 months. And clearly that was unsustainable. But the interesting thing to me is the earnings look like they're going to be lucky to be about 35 cents next year. And yet the share price has only come down to about $19. So it's trading on a price to earnings ratio of about 55. Now, clearly everyone's expecting the earnings growth to come back as they use more consumables, you know, because everyone's sort of over-ordered, if you like, in the recent years. But to me, it just shows you how people are really clamoring into what they think is safe. You know, these growth stocks that haven't failed yet or, you know, more insensitive to the economic environment. And what it's doing is it's producing a bifurcated market where you've got these very, very, you know, increasingly smaller group of high-quality businesses that people are just paying these enormous multiples for. And then you've got this sort of the reprobates, which is, you know, the cyclical stocks or coal stocks or, you know, all these companies that have been demonized for some reason, and people don't want to own them because we're potentially going into a recession. And in fact, the US and Europe might already be in it. And so they're trading at low valuation. So again, you've got this conundrum of, do I zag now while everyone else is still zigging, sort of repeating the crazy behavior of the previous bull market that we all thought ended, you know, 8 months ago, because they're all just, you know, going into these same high risk stocks and a lot of them with no earnings and things, or do you buy these sort of lower quality, low statistically cheap stocks where if they work out, I'm actually going to get a really nice return over the next few years, but they are risky and not as reliable as the others. So that's how I'd sort of sum up the current environment and reporting season.
Well, we won't ask you to answer that question of which category you go into, but we will ask you one thing that I guess annoys us a little bit here is the amount of jargon in the investing world. And one that has got my attention recently is how we call it both reporting season and earnings season, and it means exactly the same thing. So settle a debate for us, reporting season or earnings season, which one is it?
The longer time goes on, and you particularly see this in long bull markets, is it becomes more less of earnings season and more reporting season, because the abuse of EBITDA numbers and all these new metrics we get, you know, classic bull market peak stuff, you know, and you see, it always happens. And like they say, no one rings a bell at the top of a bull market, but you can see all the evidence there, you know, the butchered earnings and EBITDA numbers. And I mean, we don't have this a lot in Australia, but in America, if anyone's ever looking at US stocks, don't just look at the cash profits or the reported earnings. Go and have a look at how much stock compensation is getting paid to these technology companies and make sure you include that. It's just phenomenal. Like, we're not talking, you know, 5% different EPS. For some business, we're talking 30%, 50%. You know, these are enormous amounts of money that are essentially being given away because they don't want to pay cash to all these new starts, and they've got to encourage these people to come to their tech company because there's so many choices. It's an enormous cost. But I think Warren Buffett used to say in his books, you know, he was particularly critical of EBITDA, which is an accounting number rather than the free cash flow number, which is more important. And just who does, you know, I think he said something like, who does he think pays the expenses, the fairies?
Well, Nathan, that actually leads nicely onto our next question. Well, Bryce and I are really interested in this concept of what matters and what doesn't. And whenever we have CEOs join us on the show, we like to ask them what metrics matter and what metrics don't in their industry. We both come from a retail background, and you know, metrics like same store sales or sales per square foot were really important, but a lot of people outside the retail industry didn't really think about them a lot. So when you're analyzing a company, we want to ask you that same question: what matters and what doesn't? You've said that EBITDA doesn't matter. Is there anything else there that you really look towards, or anything that you think people speak a lot about that perhaps isn't that important?
Yeah, I think the number one for me is the price to earnings ratio, which we still use as a shorthand to give people the impression of what expectations are built into the share price. It's actually funny, I think when you start to learn about investing, the price to earnings ratio is actually somewhat confusing, because it actually should be the opposite way around, which is called the earnings yield. I think that actually makes a lot more sense to people. That's basically the profits divided by the share price. So it's like saying, if I bought a company today for a dollar and I bought the whole thing and it's got profits of 5 cents, you know, then the price to earnings ratio is 20. It's the market value divided by the profits. But the other way around is actually, well, the earnings yield is 5%. So basically your return should be 5% plus whatever growth. And I think intuitively that actually makes a lot more sense. But for some reason, Australia adopted this acronym, whatever it's called, in many, many years ago. It's never changed. So it actually confuses people. So I think people understand interest rates just, you know, genetically through mortgages and borrowing money and that type of thing. And then, but I think that the damage it does is it teaches people to think in statistical terms as to what's cheap and expensive. And that's where you get to this rub about, you know, value investing and growth investing. And, you know, and the biggest mistake people can make is just buying that low quality stuff, trading at a discount, and just missing out on the incredible growth and of the great businesses. And what really does matter, I think, is an important one sort of tied to that, is the return on equity is very useful, because it's more the concept than the actual number. The actual number does matter, because as Charlie Munger says, the longer you own a business, the more likely your return is going to be that return on equity figure. So it doesn't matter really how much you pay for that business. If you own it long enough, that's what your return's going to be. So you want to own the businesses producing higher return on equity. And that's why the ResMeds and the CSLs and the Domino's Pizzas trade at such big valuations, because they can just continue to invest and grow their businesses at those high rates for a long time. But the statistical cheap stuff, sometimes it's alluring because it feels cheap and safe, but they're the worst quality businesses. But what you have to remember is just that return on equity for the great business works for decades. And the cheap business, the longer you own it, the more likely something is to go wrong. So, you know, they're best avoided, but there are times when you go through those big falls that sometimes they're just worth it because the returns are so high and they can come so quickly.
Mm. So, Nathan, it's that part of the interview that we really look forward to, and it's picking your brains on a couple of specific stocks that you're covering. So we've asked if you could bring two or three companies to sort of unpack and explain the thesis, why you're interested in them, how it kind of matches your investment philosophy as well. So over to you for the first one. What is it, why you like it, and perhaps a bear case as well.
Yeah. What are the risks?
There's always plenty of them. I'll give you a stock. I actually really didn't want to talk about it because I think my name's becoming associated with this stock, and it is risky in some senses, but it just has, its potential is huge, and I don't know many other companies like this. And
you say and you don't Peter want to Lynch, talk about it, know, but then you say it's potentially huge. We're all ears.
Well, the problem is there's actually not a lot of great things to choose from at the moment, because the good stuff's really expensive, which leaves you with the mediocre stuff. And I don't really want to be on record talking about the mediocre stuff in case it blows up and everyone thinks I'm an idiot.
Fair call.
So again, like this, I'm talking about this professional reputation. Like this is real, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this company I'm associated with is Frontier Digital Ventures, and the background to it is it operates in emerging markets, about sort of 18 different countries. It's a small stock. It's only about $350 million market cap. The guy who runs it is a guy called Sean DiGregorio, and his background was from about 2000 to 2009 as one of the senior executives at realestate.com.au. And then he got poached from there to come and fix up a company that was called iProperty, which was a similar business but in Southeast Asia. And he 10-bagged that stock. So I think he came in and it was like 72 cents or something, and he sold it back to REA Group, funnily enough, at about $7 or something like that. So this guy has, you know, tremendous reputation. He knows these businesses inside out. And what he did was he decided to take the money that he'd made through iProperty and start his own business called Frontier Digital Ventures. Now, it's in online classifieds for property and cars, and we know that these are amongst the greatest businesses ever created. Like you've only got to go and look at REA's results or Rightmove in the UK. Like once you're the dominant property classifieds business in a country, it is the closest thing to a license to print money. But the trick with this business, because there's always a catch, is that it operates, like the gem actually in the portfolio at the moment is Zameen, which is in Pakistan. So who wants to invest in Pakistan at the moment when Sri Lanka is just, you know, social unrest, and there's a tiny bit of Sri Lankan business in Frontier, and also Myanmar where the army's taken over recently, and again civil unrest. So no one wants this exposure in the best of times, yet alone when interest rates are going up around the world, and now sovereign countries like Pakistan are running out of foreign exchange, and there's a big risk to their currency. But the valuation of this stock is it's probably trading, you know, I think this business could, in 4 years, maybe could do $200 million in revenue. The business at the moment has got is worth market value about $350 million. There's $30 million of cash on the balance sheet, so there's no financial risk in that sense. So you're potentially paying about a bit over 1.5 times revenue. Now, recently, REA Group and these sort of companies were trading at 15 times revenue. Now, for a business, for Frontier to trade at 15 times revenue, that means it needs to have the profit margins that an REA Group has. Now, I believe they'll get there over time, and one of the reasons I believe they'll get there is because they're not only just doing the advertising like REA Group relies on, they're also doing, they've cracked transactions. So they're taking a lot more of the money involved in the property sector in addition to what leads up to a property transaction in that sense. So insurance, or if a developer was trying to sell 20 units in a building, then in Pakistan, they're taking an 11% clip on each sale. So, which sounds like an enormous number, but the problem is they have to use a lot of staff to earn that money. So, you know, you'd much rather earn 2 or 3% for doing a lot less. But it just goes to show you that that market is actually, you know, some multiple, I think 5 or 7 times bigger than the, or many more times bigger than the advertising market, which interestingly, REA Group are now actually just starting to scratch and tell people that's where the growth is coming from. So this is a business no one wants to own in this environment. Looks extraordinarily cheap, but it's just got yuck written all over it for most people. And you're going to have to go through 18 months of pain because it's a small stock. There's a lot of small cap fund managers that are losing money at the moment, or their returns are really poor, so they're suffering outflows. So that when they have to sell the stock, obviously the share price falls quite a lot. And just, you know, the risks in Pakistan with the currency and these sort of things are real. But I'm just trying to stay focused for the next 5 or 10 years because, like at the moment, that Zameen investment alone is worth $300 million. Mm. So that's basically all of that's what's Frontier. So basically getting the other 17 countries for free, assuming that the Pakistan currency doesn't collapse, which is where most of the worry is at the moment. But in future, the Latin American business is where the real value is. And to give you some sort of gauge as to what, you know, the founder, Sean, thinks he can build here, he says in his presentations that he's aiming to build a $3.5 to $5 billion business. And at the moment, it's $350 million. So even if you lose the mean, obviously it's painful, but that's not really where the future value is. So you could still make many times your money, but you're really going to have to earn this. I've been invested at 50 cents a share since 2016. So I've owned it for 6 years and it hasn't even doubled. You know, it's back to, back to 83 cents yesterday. And over that time, you think you could have bought Google, right, and made 3 or 4 times your money with the safest and best business in the world. So has it been a good risk return? Absolutely not. But I'm trying to stay focused on the next 5 years. But it's certainly the stock that's of most interest to me.
Mm. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's why I love having these conversations, because I had never heard of Frontier Digital Ventures, and it's just a fascinating company doing really interesting work. And I think it's just a good reminder why I love investing, because you just learn about these things that you wouldn't otherwise know about. Like looking through their portfolio, you know, they're touching all corners of the world with some of these businesses they run. So Nathan, that's one. We could talk about it more, but we're excited to get to a second company that's on your mind, on your watch list, maybe in your portfolio. What's another one that stands out for you at the moment?
Yeah, I should just quickly say the worst thing about Frontier is all my friends and family are in it. My reputation's on the line. So if it doesn't work out, I'll be skipping to Pakistan anyway. So I'll get a job there at Zameen. The second stop for me would be ASX stock ticker is MAF, M-A-F. It used to be called Moelis, but it's MA Financial now. So hasn't been around very long. I think it listed in 2017. So MAF is a company that's basically a mini Macquarie. So most people are familiar with Macquarie. It's an investment bank that's become an extremely large funds management business and is really a key stock in most retiree portfolios. So this company used to be called Moelis, and it came from a conversation that a guy called Andrew Pridham, who's also the president of the Sydney Swans, had with a guy called Ken Moelis. And it's worth actually going to read a couple of interviews about Ken Moelis because it's really interesting. But he started a small investment bank in America and he really liked Andrew and said, let's start up a Moelis in Australia. So I think that was 2009. And in 2017, the company IPO'd. And I think it was only like $1.50 or maybe a couple of bucks a share. And Andrew Pridham has had two young offsiders I was going to tell you a funny story then, but that's not, this, not, that story is not for live camera. I actually have a relationship with one of the guys back in Adelaide in college, but that's a story for another time. Anyway, these two guys have done very well. So really it's been the three of them driving this business, and Andrew sort of stepped back a little bit recently and he's letting these two younger guys take over. And the key to the business is, one, it's just small. And if you look at these sort of investment banking funds management businesses, it's a really reliable business model. Like some of the most fantastic businesses in the world are the Brookfields and KKRs and these guys. You can grow very big over a very long period of time. You know, whereas Macquarie is sort of, you know, very mature business and you can't expect too much growth. You know, MA Financial is really only second innings. And the interesting thing about it is the sort of longer it goes on, the safer it gets. Because this is a business where you're really reliant on the individuals working in the business. You know, this isn't CSL where you've got the number one blood products business in the world and you've got decades of research and development, you know, billions and billions of dollars behind you, and it's really hard to take you on. This is a business just where the value of the business is in the people working there. And because they've been quite successful and they're getting more successful now, they're starting to attract more people, and it's all about talent in that game, in sort of investment banking and funds management. And the good thing is they really incentivize people well with owning shares in the business. And that, you know, the idea that the founders and the owners and the people who work in the business own shares is really, really important to me. And in fact, it's almost probably the most important thing. I hate just seeing these situations where you see companies that they bring in a new CEO, you know, take Mike Smith at ANZ all those years ago, we're going to go and dominate Asia, even though Asia's already full of banks. And they, you know, bank waste all this money on acquisitions, and then all of a sudden they all blow up, as they're always going to. And then the CEO leaves with a big golden handshake, and then the new CEO comes in and they pay him just as much money to fix the mess, and you're almost behind where you started many years ago, and as a shareholder you've made no money. So we really want the opposite of that. And Matt's just attracting more and more talent as it goes on. And because it's not, you can find these niches in, you know, across all sorts of industries of where to make money. Now, obviously things have been very good for investment banks and fund managers more recently. So the earnings per share are about, you know, between 40 and 44 cents at the moment. The share price has come back from 10 to 6. And this is another one where I can't stress the importance of portfolio allocation enough, because in that bear market a few years ago, I stuck with FDV and had most of my money there, and it's done nothing. And I put some money into MAF, which went from a low of like $1.29 to $10. you know, and I'm sitting here going, like, FDV was supposed to be the one, and I should be sitting in an apartment looking over Bondi Beach now instead of living in inner Sydney. And that's the difference that portfolio allocation makes. So don't skip over that part ever. But, you know, Matt's probably trading on about 15 times earnings now, which I actually think is all right long term. But you just got to remember that those earnings are really currently boosted by a lot of increase in values in things like hotels, which you've probably seen across the papers the last year. It's been a bidding frenzy for any pub on the East Coast. Mm. So that's been really helpful for them. There's, you know, the earnings in investment banking have been great. There's lots of merger and acquisition activity. You know, and asset price have been going up. So really everything's been running as well as it possibly could. But, you know, these are cyclical businesses and their fortunes are tied to market activity and asset prices. So that M&A activity is going to slow down, obviously, and that's what the market's trying to price in. You know, I'd love another crack at this below $4, and I'm really hopeful we get another proper bear market next year as interest rates really actually start to impact the economy and financial markets. But it just ticks all the boxes I like. I really like finding small businesses with the potential to become much larger businesses over decades. You know, that's what I really enjoy about the job. You know, it's not going to happen tomorrow, and, you know, these sort of stocks can fall 50% many times, you know, over those periods. But when you find those founder-led businesses, they just tend to work out much better, and there's just more and more statistical evidence every year that founder-led businesses work out much better. And I've got a chart I use in my presentations about shows from 1990 the difference between the stocks in the S&P 500, which is the major American index, how they perform versus the rest of the S&P 500. And I've only got the chart up until 2014, and the lines look ridiculous. But keep in mind that from 2014 to 22 was a, you know, a tech boom, and all those big tech companies are run by their founders, basically all of them anyway. So you imagine what that chart looks today. Like, it is literally off the charts in that sense. We don't have as many, unfortunately, in Australia, but we have plenty of good ones.
Love it, Nathan. Well, we unfortunately are getting close to the end of the interview, so a massive thank you to yourself and also InvestSmart for sponsoring this episode. Certainly taken a lot of actionable insights from it. Now, if you would like more info on what InvestSmart are doing, head to investsmart.com.au. We'll chuck a link in our show notes. But we always finish with three questions for all of our guests, so Ren, take it away.
So Nathan, the first one is, do you have any books that you consider must read?
Look, I'm sure everyone on this show has come and told you all the ones they need to read, but the one thing I'd say, if you're really serious about learning more about investing and you've got a bit of time to put into it, just don't skip Warren Buffett's, particularly the earlier letters to Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. Just pick one a week or one a month to get through, and there's a period of about 20 years where there's absolutely no substitute for that, far than any one book. But again, if you've just read chapters 8 and 20 of Intelligent Investor, you've read your Peter Lynch book, and you've read some Buffett, that's really all you need to know. Anything past there becomes more complicated, and I think from all those books I read, I actually ended up focusing too much on risk and didn't focus enough on the imagination side of what the great businesses could become over 10 or 15 years. And that's where the money's made. Mm. So I think it's one important lesson is when you come in as a new investor, you're really worried about losing money. And particularly as a professional, like you're around all these seasoned guys and you don't want to lose any money. So you really focus on the risk, but I think you take that too far. And the real money is made in understanding what a great business is, why it can continue to be a great business for the next 10 or 20 years, and really thinking broadly about new ways it could make money or how it could develop. Because if you can have that insight, that's a very valuable insight, and that's the difference between living in inner city Sydney and looking over Bondi Beach every morning.
So, Nathan, the second question we like to ask is, forget valuation, forget what it's trading at the moment, forget the company as an investment, just purely on the company, what it does and who runs it. What's the best company you've ever come across?
So I'll just stick to Australia because it's more useful. But probably Domino's was just about be up there. It's been incredible. It's incredibly well run. If you just read the detail for anyone listening who wants to read, I should probably be sporking my own quarterly letters. But an ex-mentor of mine I used to work with, he runs Selector Funds, and his quarterlies run about 100 pages long, so they're in depth, to say the least. But if you really want to learn the insides of the great business in Australia, just go back and read those. They're the best thing on anywhere. They're the best thing you could read, full stop, because they're ASX-listed stocks and the detail he goes into is quite incredible. And Domino's, it just continues to grow in new countries. It does such a great job, marrying technology with the reality of actually delivering physically a pizza. All the way it's developed management over years so they can actually expand to such a wide range of countries and keep the wheels on, without falling off and blowing up a lot of money, has made them by far the number one person that the head Domino's company wants to run their different countries. That's how important they are. So important now to the actual top Domino's head stock. It's incredible. It's a great story too, because the founder, Don May, started delivering pizzas and now he drives Lamborghinis around the Gold Coast.
Yeah. Well, we've had Don May on the show before, so we'll include the link to that interview in the show notes. But it is a pretty incredible story. Who knew that pizzas would be the best growth stock of the 2010s? But Nathan, final question. We always like to finish with this. If you think back to your earlier self starting out in markets, subscribing to that Tabcorp IPO when it happened, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Yeah, look, there's a few bits. One, I should have bought that house in Conroe Heights in Mount Gambier when I was 21. That would actually have me sitting overlooking Bondi Beach at the moment, that one decision alone. So if you can actually get onto the property market at some point, it is a good idea, but obviously we never thought interest rates would go to zero and see the growth that we have. So that was one critical mistake I made. The other one was not just putting all my money into CSL. That's probably the most practical one, I think, for most people, is just find that great business. And obviously it takes a bit of work to work out what a good business is, but it doesn't take that much work. I mean, you follow Intelligent Investor for 6 months and read a few books and whatever, and you'll understand what a good business is versus a rubbish business. Mm. And then you just add a few things in about understanding a bit about valuation and those sort of expectations and things. And then just really do your own work and don't listen to anyone else. That's one of the pitfalls I made. I think that there's, risk becomes such a big issue in the business when I started early that it took over from thinking creatively about what these great businesses could become, because the best way to reduce risk is to buy the great businesses. And you'd just be amazed at how much money you can make on the market over time. And you can tell like the frustration in my voice. You know, Frontier was at $3, I wouldn't be so frustrated. But, what people underestimate is that compounding. And you only get that compounding in the great businesses. And yes, every now and then you'll get a Whitehaven Coal at $1 where you can see it's actually going to make as much money in 1 year as its total market cap. And it's fine to jump on those, but they're pretty rare. So again, try and get a house or apartment, just get that taken care of and find the best business in the world now. I mean, you're not even back then, you had to buy ASX stocks, but you don't have to anymore. It's very easy to buy international stocks. So there's much higher quality businesses over there, much more of them. But also the earlier you can find them, the better. You know, if Frontier ends up being the next REA group, then finding it today is so much better than finding it in 5 years when everybody knows it's the next REA group. That's really the key with investing, I think, is to see the value before the market's priced it in.
Well, Nathan, it's been fascinating speaking with you today. Thank you so much for sharing your time. Loved the breakdown of portfolio management and the 2-4-6 rule. I'll certainly be looking at how my portfolio stacks up against that. Definitely won't match 2-4-6, that's for sure. But I'm sure our audience took a lot of, as I said, actionable insights from that. So we do really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on at another point in the future. Thank you very much.
It sounds like your portfolio looks like my personal one. Thanks a lot, boys.
Nice. Thanks, Nathan.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian Financial Services Licence and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.